Yes.
Hey, Michael Monroe in the house. You're listening to Walk in the Park, and we're rocking and rolling and doing the blues punk thing. With my man Chris Shepherd here, man, and we're rocking, and we came, we saw, and we rocked viciously and violently. All right.
I'll take it.
I'm walking the floor over you.
Walking the floor.
I'm walking the floor.
Walking the floor over you.
Hola, señores and señoritas. How are you doing out there in podcast land? This is your old pal, Chris Shiflett. And yes, you are listening to America's favorite podcast, Walking the Floor. Okay, now look, I'm recording this right now, literally right after I recorded the ramble for the Paul Franklin episode that came out 2 weeks ago, because I'm going on vacation after we finish these Foo Fighters shows this weekend, and I don't want to be bothered with having to edit a podcast and put it up. So there's nothing new. I got nothing new to say. Hopefully there won't be some like catastrophic thing happen between now and this thing getting posted. But you never know, because we live in the age of Donald Trump and humanity might be wiped out by the time this thing goes up. And then no one will get to hear my awesome interview with Michael Monroe. That would suck. So there's nothing new going on, but I will just remind you of a couple of things. One being the Walking the Floor Spotify playlist. If you don't follow it, what the hell is wrong with you? Get over to Spotify and follow it. And for that matter, did you know that you could, you can listen to this podcast in Spotify? It's in Spotify. It's all over the digital, streaming services, but it's definitely in Spotify. It's on YouTube. It's in the iTunes store. It's everywhere you want it to be, so check it out. Of course, you know that because you're listening to it right now, so I guess I'm sort of preaching to the choir. Anyway, what else? I got a gig coming up July 20th at City Winery in Boston. I'm going to be opening for Rhett Miller, doing an acoustic set. I'm going to play a bunch of new songs from my as-yet-unreleased album. Coming out someday, next year probably. I'm going to try to find somewhere to do a gig in New York City on the 18th, which would be like a little warm-up show before the Boston show. Because I have a night off in New York City, going to look for a gig. We'll see what happens. Fingers crossed. I'll let you know. Okay, let's get to the business end of podcasting. You know about Zounds.com. It's where you go to buy your gear for music stuff online. But did you know that every order over $599 and above is eligible for their exclusive 12 payment plan? There's no application process. There is no interest charged ever. All you gotta do is just pay that first monthly installment and your gear ships immediately. Booyah! Also, support for Walking the Floor comes from D'Addario. D'Addario, a fine maker of USA-made instrument strings and musical accessories, is committed to sustainability through the Playback program, recycling over 1 million used instrument strings. For more information on the Playback program and how to help in its mission of reaching 2.5 million strings in 2018, please visit D'Addario.com/playback. You know what just occurred to me? I bet you can get your D'Addario strings over at Zounds.com. I didn't check that, but I bet if you look, you can. And that, my friends, is a sponsorship combo platter. Boom! All right, let's get to the interview. Now, I bet most of you folks out there listening have heard me ramble on over the years about how much I love Finland's one and only Hanoi Rocks, one of the greatest bands that has ever existed, in my not-so-humble opinion. I don't know if I would have fallen in love with the idea of playing guitar in a rock and roll band in quite the same way if I hadn't discovered them around the eighth grade. I think it was like 1984 or so. Right time, right place, right moment in the changing of the guard from heavy metal to glam rock that was happening in Southern California, in large part thanks to their influence. I remember flipping through Kerrang! Magazine and seeing a picture of them and just going, what is that? I could just tell. You could just see that it was something different. And I think Michael Monroe was probably the first thing about them that I noticed because, you know, he was hard to miss with, he had like giant spiky blonde hair and he's super thin and tall and crazy bitching outfits. And I don't know, you could just tell it was some other thing that was a little bit different than like the Iron Maiden and Dio records that I was listening to at the time. So when my older brother Scott came home with their record that came out that year called Two Steps from the Move, I fell in love, and that was that. I took a left turn into glam rock, and I never came back, baby. I'm still there. Still glam rock for life, kids. By 1985, sadly, they had crashed and burned in drug addiction and tragedy, swapping guitars, clothes, and lovers along the way. But then Michael Monroe went on to a very long solo career, eventually putting a new version of Hanoi Rocks back together many years later, that was around for a little while, made a few albums, and then he went back to his solo career, and he's still rocking today. And I'm happy to say I've gotten to know Michael over the years and consider him a friend. We met up last summer when Foo Fighters went through Helsinki, and after he interviewed me for his upcoming documentary, I interviewed him for this podcast. And as usual, got to ask him all my little super fan questions that I've always wondered over the years. That's why I love doing this podcast. It's great. When I get to interview one of my heroes, I get to get into the weeds, man. I mean, who knew that they originally asked Prince to produce their classic LP, Back to Mystery City? I didn't know that. I bet you didn't know that. So we got that and many other sordid details right here. This is Michael Monroe on Walking the Floor.
Podcast, I have sound effects, right?
No, not too much.
Oh, all right.
Just our voices.
Our voices. Okay.
Yeah.
No nose flute or anything.
Oh, there you go. That'll work.
Yeah. Time has come. It is time. Time takes time.
Well, let's just start with the documentary that you're working on. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah.
When do you think that that's going to come out?
Next fall.
What's the scope of it? Is it like from you're a baby till now, going through all the various years and bands and things?
Yeah, it's about, it's my pretty much like the my autobiography, the book, which is not out in English yet.
Right. I know that because I've looked for it.
Okay. I'm chuffed. But we're working on it because we got the Hanoi book out translated now, and so the next step is to get the Michael Monroe book out. It's pretty much my life from the beginning of I used to have this imaginary friend who appeared only to me, and his name was Ali, and he was like an Eastern looking guy. And then I kept seeing it, but my mother and my grandma said, oh, there's nobody there. I said, can't you see him there? Right there, see, sitting on the back of a chair, and there was nobody there. So one time, I remember the first time I was afraid of him, he disappeared, I never saw him again. It kind of starts with an image like that. I think the director's planning to, he liked that story. But it's about my life from the beginning to this day, and having some footage from throughout the years. And we're supposed to be going to New York, London, you know, Stockholm, going to look at some of the old places, and people like yourself, people who are really important to me in my life and career, and presentation of this little life, you know, more or less as it is, you know.
Well, there's been, you know, in the last year or so, maybe in the last couple of years, there's been, you know, that Hanoi box set came out, and a couple of books have come out. How come this is all happening now? Why is there this great looking back? And were you involved in those releases, by the way? The book? Well, there's a couple.
The Hanoi
of
book.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Hanoi book that came out in Finland is now out in English. It's the same book.
Yeah.
So I was involved in that. Well, right now it's been 30 years since my first solo album, Not Just So Long, was released. So
right.
It's 30 years of solo. My solo career has been going for 30 years, so therefore, now, for the first time ever, there's a compilation, you know, the best of, or Michael Monroe, the best, modestly.
Hey, why is that record not available in Spotify and iTunes, Nights Are So Long, your first one?
Well, it was released only in Scandinavia and Japan. And then, with the help of that record, I got signed to Polygram Records in New York.
Mm.
So I kind of used it as an international demo, but I guess it was just never released elsewhere.
Yeah, well, it's to this day, though. It's like you can't find it. It's not in Spotify.
Is that right?
Or the iTunes store, any of those things.
Oh, I got to look into that. I'm so
you got to get that thing up there.
Yeah.
Because that's a great record.
Thank you.
Well, I love that record.
You do?
Yeah.
Wow. Well, it had some of the first attempts of songwriting at me. I mean, I stopped writing in Hanoi because Andy always said he had a better idea, and I just kind of gave up on it. And as a solo artist, that's when I really came onto my own as a songwriter. But Can't Go Home Again. That Can't Go Home Again was a pretty good song, I thought. That's a nice one.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's a version of It's a Lie. You know, that's a ballad, the slow song, It's a Lie?
Yeah.
The original version, the demo, I did with Steve Bader's when we were living together in London after Hanoi was breaking up. See, Jimmy Zero, the Dead Boys guitarist, he wrote that song. And Steve had a demo of it already when the first few times when we met, me and Andy hooked up with Steve in Portobello in London, like 1981, 82 or something, when we were moving there. And Steve played that to us and said Hanoi could do that song. And Andy, of course, said, oh, he's got something better. So, but I liked it. But now, then in 85, when Hanoi broke up and I moved in with Steve Bader's, his wife moved out and got together with Andy.
What? Really?
Yeah. With whom I had had 2 years earlier, I had had a really destructive affair, and which resulted in, you know, not being friends with Steve for a long time. We went through a lot of stuff. Yeah, just ruined. I just, you know, I was a hermit, totally isolated from the rest of the world for like 1983, the whole year. You can even tell in the way I dress is mostly like black and white. And then when me and Steve became friends again, and that woman had the nerve to, Steve called her a teacher, and a succubus was one word. She like the next victim. But so Steve used to say, you know, Hanoi rocks in lots of new church, we're good friends, you know, we swap guitars, we swap wives, you know, clothes, and what, no problem.
Were you guys kind of around the same scene in London together?
Yeah, around the same time.
Right.
Hanoi rocks started playing at the Marquee. We had a residency for a couple of months, like played once a week. And the Lords of the New Church were the only other band that, or a scene, so to speak, that happened there since the punk thing. Only thing that had happened since the punk thing was the Stray Cats.
Right.
And they were cool, of course. But when we came around, there
was they around London at the same time as you guys, or was that a little bit before? Right.
Yeah. They were a little bit before. Yeah.
What year was it when you guys moved there?
It was like 1982 mainly. That was like the year that we relocated, that we got ourselves based there.
And why? How come you moved there from Finland?
Well, from Finland, first objective we had, the first goal was to get the hell out of Finland as far as possible, as soon as possible.
Like, what was Finland like at that time?
It was crazy.
I imagine it being kind of gray or something, you know? Like, I think that's how, because I think that, I interviewed Sammy for this, and I think that he described it as being kind of very gray. Tenement blocks and that sort of thing. Which I think you guys must have stuck out like a sore thumb.
Oh, yeah.
Because you guys were anything but gray.
Exactly, yeah. It was like grays and browns, and I remember walking towards the crowd, I mean, against, you know, a multitude of people, and I was a little taller than everybody else too, and I was looking around, just, wow, this is the story of my life. I mean, I'm not going against the grain to rebel, I'm just going that way. But everyone else is like,
right.
Everyone's like looking like really gloomy, and kind of there's like a shadow hanging over from like World War II or whatever, I don't know, but still, people are really kind of like depressed or serious and no smiling. And I think Hanoi Rocks, one of the greatest things that Hanoi accomplished, I think, in Finland was we've pretty much forced people to, you know, lighten up a little and learn to laugh at themselves and accept difference, because it was intolerance here at the time in the late 70s. All of a sudden, there was this fashion of everybody looked like the Happy Days or American Graffiti, you know.
Oh, right.
James Dean kids, we called
them. There's
a
huge Lisa's rockabilly scene here, right?
Rockabilly, yeah.
Yeah.
But that was kind of like in between, you know, Teddy Boys and Skinheads. It was not nice. It was nasty. They used to go to karate, and then, you know, about 10 or 20 kids would jump on anybody who had a little bit longer hair or looked a little different.
Mm. Like
some old, poor old hippies, you know, they were like really. People get killed and stuff, and like, burn their hair. And
let's
stuff.
Get the hell out of here before the rockabillys get us.
Yeah, really. I mean, the radio. I mean, over the weekend, going to the train station weekends would have been like suicide. Except me and Andy, we used to walk through there. Andy had the creepers. He had a drape jacket, and he had his hairdo like a pompadour, even though it was different colors. So they were like, huh? He had the coolest drape jacket with leopard lapels and bright red, and they're like, "Huh? What? This is not a
what is that guy?
Yeah, is it a hippie or a punk?"
I don't know whether I want to kick his ass or not.
Yeah, exactly. They were confused. They were way over the head. So it was like, and I was wearing I had like hair down to here, black, and on top it was blonde, and I had like electric blue PVC pants and a white jacket from a mental hospital that Andy drew a huge dick in the back and all that. So, but we had to get out of here. In Stockholm, at least you didn't get beat up for the way you looked. And we lived on the streets, me and Sammy and Nasty. Andy had a girlfriend, he was smart. Like, what do you call a guitar player who broke up with his girlfriend? Homeless, ha ha ha.
So, I thought that was a drummer.
Well, yeah, it goes for both.
Yeah, it works either way.
So we were on the streets.
So first you went to Stockholm.
Yeah, me and Sammy and Nasty were, we had the original drummers, Jip Casino.
Yeah.
He had a rehearsal place at a subway station, but unfortunately couldn't stay there overnight. So we had to like we were homeless, walking around the streets, and we rehearsed it was a subway station where the trains go on the platform. It was like a fallout shelter. So you open this huge metal door and it went down underground even lower, and there was always a guard that came to make sure that no bands were rehearsing there, you know.
Really?
Yeah, like by midnight. You have to get out of there. But sometimes we were hiding behind the speakers, and when the guy was gone, we're like, okay, let's play. We played all night till, you know, 5-6 in the morning. And then we discovered one time that you go up the escalators. We climbed up there and got the door open. And there's a field where somebody was growing carrots. Carrots. Like, oh, wow, food.
For a bunch of homeless rock and rollers, that must have been like a good find.
Yeah.
We've got dinner, boys.
Yeah. And then we started hanging out with these other homeless people, like some Arabs and people from like Malta, Afghanistan. And they were like refugees or whatever. And they had the shoplifting down, man. It was like whole chickens, you know, and they would bring out of the store. I was like, well, how did you get that? Incredible. And they would hang out at this club called Club 88 over the weekend. And there was a Swedish guy who always invited a whole bunch of us to his house. His house was a little outside Stockholm. It had a huge mountain of empty beer cans behind it. And we had at least a roof over our heads, you know, the weekends. But it was, you know, 6 months. Me and Nasty and Sammy, we used to do the same round and ask for change. And then we'd see how much we had. If we could all have a hamburger each or share one or buy a bottle of wine to forget about the hunger. And, you know, that's how we started.
Well, let's back up just a little bit before that.
Started out with nothing. I still got most of it left.
That's a good one. How did you guys get together in Helsinki? Like, how did the band form?
Okay.
I know that Andy was in,
Breard.
Breard.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, they were the first punk single, I think, in Finland, so-called punk. It was called I Really Hate You.
And Sammy was like a kid, wasn't he? Like Sammy 11 or 12 or something?
He was younger than everyone else. He was a couple of years younger than me. So I was 17. Sammy was like barely 16. But they were in this band called Pelle Miljoona, which was kind of like a punk, but they sang in Finnish. And I and Andy, we met at a rehearsal place in the basement of a church where I used to live in Helsinki. There was a rehearsal place there. It was kind of like for you know, for teenage kids, or, you know, to have like a club activity and stuff. It was that kind of, you know, room where they had different things happening, and then bands could rehearse there. So my band rehearsed there, and Breard and Andy's band was rehearsing there. Mm. And once I forgot, I left something there, so I went back when they were rehearsing. I walked in on them, and Andy was like, "Oh, wow, you play guitar?" He thought I was a guitar player, because I wanted to be a singer. But I played guitar because I didn't have a good enough guitar player in my band. So Andy always did this. He thought, you know, when he figured it was another guitar player, he says, "Okay, let's jam." And then he'd like play the best solo he could, you know, really like try to like play the other guy to hell. And then they go, "Okay, you go ahead."
Yeah. Now it's your turn.
Now your turn. So I was like, "Well, okay." So I played some, you know, solos, some riffs. I said, "Oh, wow, you're pretty good." So how long have you been playing? I said, "Well, I'm not really a guitar player. I'm a singer, but I'm looking for a guitar player." Oh, okay. So we started talking and planning for the band. We had this idea of the most perfect band where everybody would be a strong, like the Dolls. Everybody was a strong individual, you know, in the band. There wasn't just like the front man or the Mick and Keith kind of thing. That would be everybody, and really the kind of music and kind of style, you know, dress look cool, and you know, the Alice Cooper band.
Where'd the look come from? Because, I mean, you guys pretty much right away had a very distinct look, you know, that nobody at that time looked like.
Yeah. Well, to me, like I said, Black Sabbath was the first band I saw on TV that made me want to be a singer. But Rolling Stones, the Alice Cooper band were one of the biggest. Neil Smith, the drummer, he had the coolest hair.
Totally.
That's the hair I always wanted.
Right.
And it was so cool. The mystery of the, you really didn't really know what they, you know, you only saw a few photos, and they had the, you know, the patent leather and all these scarves, and the way they dressed, it looks so cool, man.
Yeah.
So that was one of the main one of really big influences on us, on me anyway. And Little Richard was the first, you know, guy wearing makeup and hair, big hair and stuff.
Right.
So when I
but there was like there was a real like distinct thing with like the smoking jackets, you know, the old suit jackets with like tight jeans and like pointy boots or creepers and, you know, the scarves just a certain way. Like it was like there was a thing that was like uniform to your band, that
really?
Everybody in the band seemed to do in their own way.
Right.
And, you know, and I get that it was, you know, the Alice Cooper band, Mott the Hoople, all these things, that,
yeah,
New York Dolls and stuff were all thing, but it's like you guys like took all those things in like you guys were like an aggregate of all those, with a little rockabilly thrown in, a little punk rock with the creepers and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, but it's interesting that seemed like fully formed from the get-go. Or is that just my misunderstanding
of
it?
It's true. Yeah, that, it was not planned for. It was just spontaneous and natural. It just, you know, we took a little bit of everything from everywhere. Everything we saw or heard, you know, we took a little here and there, influences from different artists, different bands, and then we made it into our own. You know, like in the early 70s, there were like, even the Stones and, you know, the Faces were actually, I was even more into them than the Stones.
Sure.
And they had there was a little bit of that glammy kind of thing on every band in that time period, but everyone, we just thought that, you know, everyone should have their own thing and be really different from everyone else and put on a good show. And over here in Finland, back in the day, in those days, all you had was like this prog rock bands, you know, really serious musicians trying to act like they weren't really, you know, trying to be stars, or, you know, a lot of people hated us for daring to be sort of to even have self-confidence, let alone be like, okay, we're stars, yes, we'll look good. Of course we'll take money for our shows if it's on our own terms, yeah, sure. There's nothing wrong with being, you know, making money out of playing and put on a good show. Of course, and people pay for, you know, you want to give them their money's worth. As opposed to some guy who sits there, who stands there with his back to the audience with a dirty hair and jeans and plays 20-minute solos anyway, self-indulgent 20-minute solos anyways, putting everyone to sleep. So we wanted to, like, we shake it up and, you know, make it, you know, it was a good kick in the ass over here at the time. So, and they hated us, of course. First, they were like, well, junkies, faggots, who are, you know, at the time they even used faggot as a bad word, and they said, you know, these are not, you know, pretty much like, get out of this country. But then when we started getting ourselves a name, when we moved to, we had a manager, Zeppo, who was interested in managing the band, but when we left, went out to moved to Stockholm and lived on the streets for the first the 6 months that we were rehearsing, but they're like 4 or 5 months that we rehearsed and got the material together. Seppo was in Turkey or somewhere, he was traveling, and but he was the only guy who was internationally connected and used to bring in, you know, artists from abroad, you know, to arrange concerts, Iggy Pop and people like that. And then I called him from Stockholm and asked if he's still interested after we've been rehearsing for, you know, 4 or 5 months. And he says, yeah, sure, I'll come over. And he came over to Stockholm and he to the rehearsal place, and we played him a, you know, our set. And he was like, wow, cool. Let's try start booking you a tour in Finland. And we had one single. That first single, I Want You and Kill City Kills, which because Andy was the Andy had a, you know, this guy at the record label, the head of the label was into allowed Andy to make a single. That's why it says Hanoi Rocks with Andy McCoy on the first single.
Oh, really?
Single. Yeah. And I had that single, and we were on the streets. I went to this record store where they used to have, sell singles and stuff, and I used to go there and listen to records and talk to the guy at the store. And then he said he knew this guy at a record label. A friend of his whose name was Sanjay Tandon, he was like a born in India or something, a Stockholm guy who had a label called SOS. So he passed on the single. I left and gave the guy the single. I said, yeah, can I have this play to my friend? And that way we got a record deal eventually. The guy was interested in signing us, and then I said, okay, well, I hooked him up with the guy in Finland, and then them together, they, you know, we got the deal and started making the first album in Stockholm. Started recording Bangkok Shock, Saigon Shakes, Hanoi Rocks. So that's from rags to from rags to almost riches, rags to something, from rags to bitches. But that's how we started, you know, recording the first album. And we toured in Finland. We came to Finland at least the third tour, I think it was, when the album actually came out, even though it was supposed to be out for the first tour already. All we had was this one single, you know, for a couple of tours. But we made money anyway, some money, you know, for playing those shows. And
right, you were getting by.
Yeah, and I had a luxury. I had a roof up my head. I got right. There was this girl who, I mean, when we were on the streets, me and Nasty and Sammy, I used to be the one who was like, sort of pick a girl and you know, so to speak, seeming like I, you know, I was trying to hit on her. And then when she said, yeah, you want to come over? I said, yeah, can my friends come along? And then we all came in. Once we got to the house, we went straight to the fridge, like, okay, raid the fridge. And she'd be like, nobody would touch her. And said, yeah, oh, sorry, I'm a little bit tired now. It's just, there's plenty of room here. It's okay. We're sleeping already. So that's what
that's
we did.
That's a good scam.
So yeah, right?
For all you budding musicians out there.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Put your most attractive member out front to get the girl.
Well, Sammy and Nasty, well, you were asking about the chemistry in the band. Actually, the thing was with Hanoi, like Steve Bader's used to say, it's good to have a couple of guys who are soldiers. Like Nasty and Sammy were sort of like, in quotes, soldiers. They weren't into too much... too creative and too sort of worked up about getting their ideas. For example, like the Eagles, you know, I can understand why they broke up because there was
a bunch of songwriters.
Bunch, so much creative energy and different views. And like you said, you have to kind of make compromises to make the whole unit work. So Nasty and Sammy were great because they were just easygoing. Oh, they were happy to have a couple of beers and then, you know, play the songs. And and with me and Andy, we had a, you know, we actually never really sort of learned to know each other as properly until like 20 years later. And
really?
You know, yeah, the year 2000.
Even in those years when you were all living out of each other's pockets?
Yeah, in the 80, in 85.
Were you not close socially at that point?
No, we drifted, we were 1981, we kind of had a, when we were on the streets in Stockholm and Andy wasn't, he was at his girlfriend's place, me, Nasty and Sammy, we created this bond really tight, and it's still there. And Andy sort of, so he used to resent us for there was a time I remember when Nasty, he was screaming at Nasty on the phone. We were calling him from the drummer at Jeep Casino. He had a job at this old retired people's gym where he was at the office, and he used to let him in and stuff, and we kept our stuff there. I had one suitcase and one cardboard box in this little like a room where, and we'd go there and take showers, you know, washing, you know, then get back out in the streets. But we kind of separated. I remember Andy was back in the day, in those days, he was really furious when he saw that, you know, we've been like, I had gotten into like Speed and, you know, a little hash with those guys, the homeless people, and he was like, what the fuck, you know, don't do it. You know, like he was really mad at me. And
that's kind of ironic, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, yeah, of course. You know, look who's calling the kettle black. You know? But, yeah, so anyway, but the chemistry worked because there were, you know, everyone had their place. Mm. But Jip Cassino, the drummer, he started having some mental problems. He was not really at ease with himself, and that affected everything. And he was never happy with his playing. I was kind of like always like, oh, it's a bummer. He was having like all these fits in the studio. He would like all sunburst, start crying and stuff.
Really?
Yeah. And then Razzle would show up at our gigs in London. He would just come up to both me and Andy. He would be harassing us. He was like, hey, where's your drummer, mate? Well, he's somewhere.
Didn't he just kind of bully his way into the band?
Yeah,
almost?
Yeah, exactly. It was like he had decided.
I'm going to be your drummer.
Yeah, he was totally determined to be our drummer. He said, where's your drummer? I said, oh, somewhere here at the Marquee. I'll break his fucking legs. Said, what? Yeah, your band is great, but your drummer sucks. I'll be looking for a band like yours for 3 years, man. You got to take me. I'm your drummer. So then me and Andy were sitting around, and it was kind of a low point with us, and we were like, you know, really down in the dumps, and the spirit of the band was kind of really at the lowest point it ever was. I mean, it looked like there was not much of a future. And then Razzle had me. I said we were having problems with Jip Cassino, so I said, hey, well, this guy's been badgering me. You know, he gave me his number last time. Maybe we should call him and check him out. Oh, the same guy's been badgering me. You know, and so then we called Razzle, and he came over. That was around the time, I think Dave Dixon from Kerrang was doing an interview, and Andy fell asleep halfway through a sentence. He fell asleep. And I was like, okay. And it was like heavy hardcore junkies coming up there. But there was this guy, Chris, who was like, oh God. He was having a huge fight with this girl about cocaine, prices of cocaine in London there during the interview. And it was like totally insane. And Razzle would come up and, you know, we'd hang out, and it was a great guy. We had a great time with him. He looked at the black lipstick and platform boots. And, and, you know, so then we auditioned him without Nasty. Nasty was pretty close with Jip, so we figured it was just me, Sammy, and Andy. We took him to a place in Shepherd's Bush, Goldhawk Road, the Townhouse Studios. We had a day with he had platform boots, so it was pretty hard for him to play, but still, he wasn't that good. But we figured, you know, Jip Cassino, over the first couple of years, he evolved a lot and developed, you know, it got better. So so we figured, he looks cool. He looked like Neil Smith, the way he played. His hair, his black hair, but still the same kind of hair, same kind of style. And his hero, Keith Moon, was his idol, you know. So we figured, oh yeah, he's a cool guy. Yeah, yeah, he'll get better. Yeah, let's take him, you know.
Yeah.
And he had the spirit. His attitude saved the band.
Mm. You know, what was that like when you guys first moved to London? What was the scene like there? Were you guys, what did you expect it to be? And then what was the reality of it?
Well, I was surprised, first of all, that there were no skyscrapers. I thought it was going to be like Manhattan. So we just like walked around endlessly with Andy and just to trying to get to know the city. But we ended up at some party with that band Girl with Phil.
Phil
Lewis.
Collin.
Yeah, I wish Phil in it.
What was his name?
Phil Lewis, right?
Right. Oh yeah, yeah. The guy.
The LA Guns.
Yes.
Yeah. So he had a band called Girl originally, and they had made an album which me and Andy kind of thought was pretty cool. He looked kind of like Steven Tyler-ish, you know, album cover. And then it was their party, their record release party or something, and they had a second album, and they were showing a video that they just made, and I looked at it, and I was like, Andy, they ain't that great, man. I think we have a pretty good chance here, man. I think we're better than them. And then, as it turned out, there wasn't much of a scene. There was not much happening there.
Like, who were the other bands? You mentioned Lords of the New Church.
Lords of the New Church. Well, the Damned, of course. Whom Razzle, we used to follow them. He saw maybe 200 or 300 Damned shows. You know, he'd be like a hardcore fan of theirs. And that was, you know, Iggy. What we liked was Johnny Thunders and Heartbreakers. Mm. That was one of our favorites because Chinese Rocks was the first name that Andy suggested when we were thinking of a name for the band. And I said, well, it's already a song, so it should be more original. He said, well, how about Hanoi Rocks? I said, yes, I've seen the future, past, present, whatever, that's it. I said, that's the coolest name, cooler than the Rolling Stones, man. It's the coolest name I've ever heard, still to this day. It's one of at least one of the coolest.
Yeah, great name.
Yeah, so
was Johnny Thunders living there at that time?
No, we hadn't met Johnny yet, but the Heartbreakers, contrary to popular belief, you would think that the New York Dolls were more of an influence on us, but the Heartbreakers, the LAMF album, that was more of an influence even than the Dolls. But still, of course, the Dolls were too. But Johnny Thunders' spirit and his attitude, that was the thing. I mean, we ended up touring in Sweden with him, and we would laugh every day. We looked at the headlines. They were like, he got arrested for breaking into the airplane's the medicine cabinet or something, you know. It was always something.
When you guys eventually played on Que Sera Sera, right?
Yeah, I played sax and harp on that. That's when I was living with... I moved in with Steve, and then Steve was on the road. Johnny had broken up his girlfriend. Oh, they threw him out of the house in Stockholm, and he came to London. It's like, hey, man, I got no place. I said, well, come on, you can stay here. So I stayed with Johnny, which was quite an adventure. We went to buy food, like cereal. He had this cereal called Smacks, of course. and then he was sincerely trying to, you know, kick the habit. I mean, he told me he did heroin for 10 years, and then before he realized that he can't kick, you know, he couldn't quit. And it was like, don't ever do this to yourself, man. But it was like, he's the kind of guy that the more I see, the more I do. I mean, the speed, endless amounts of, I mean, whatever you had. Had whiz, you know. I was like, "Do you got any more, man? I dropped the package in the toilet," and he'd come like rolling his sleeve down. I said, "Oh yeah, right." So I had to hide it from him. But he had reminded me of a really important thing there with because that was around the time when Hanoi Rocks was after Razzle had died.
Right.
So I was totally devastated. I didn't know what I was going to do. You know, had no plans. All I wanted to do was make sure that Hanoi didn't become a parody of itself or a joke about that we didn't lose the integrity that the band had. At least in my mind, it was always like us against the world and not playing the corporate game and the music business. Who cares? If the band would have continued with the two guys that were coming in, that were eager to join, it would have ruined the whole thing.
Mm.
And it would have been even worse if we would have gotten successful, because surely we were most likely maybe in a position where, you know, on the verge of perhaps worldwide success, but then it would have been even worse because it would have been the wrong way. I wanted people to know the real Hanoi Razzle with the right attitude instead of some, you know, complacent, rich, you know, these guys who had, you know, the bass player especially was like, ugh, dirty old. I can just imagine him getting into little girls on the road and stuff. But I always hated that sleazy stuff. I never touched a groupie in my life. Could never imagine. it's just weird. I guess I'm a freak for a singer. But in any case, yeah, that was the Thunders. That kind of punky, the Damned, you know, big influence on us, and the Mott the Hoople stuff. And
well, how did you connect with the guys from Mott the Hoople that produced Back to Mystery City? I always wondered if there was much like interaction or acknowledgement by the 70s era sort of glitter rock, glam rock bands.
But there
like
were,
if you had any interaction with, you know, like obviously you knew the guys in Mott the Hoople, but like any of the other guys, like, you know, Mick Ronson or Alice Cooper, any of those folks, like if there was much interaction between all you guys.
Yeah, well, not at first. And, you know, we were just, I couldn't even imagine that I would ever meet Alice Cooper. I was a fan of Alice Cooper's in Finland. When Alice was in Finland doing a promotion for Muscle of Love, he was staying at this hotel. He never, didn't play a show, but I was there with the kid from my backyard, you know, and I wanted to just see him. And when he came out, it was going into a car, I patted him on the back so I could say I touched him. And then someone gave him a piece of paper and a pen, and he just sat there in a car and kind of, you know, in a stupor, and probably had a few beers.
Right.
And the car just took off, and I was like, oh, well, that's the first time I kind of met Alice. But later on, we got to know Over and Watts and Buffin, Dale Griffin, the drummer, and Pete Watts, Over and Watts. They came in when we asked Ian Hunter to produce the Back to Mystery City album.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and he declined. He didn't have the time. He wasn't interested or whatever. Also, we asked Prince to produce Back to Mystery City.
Really?
Yeah, not many people know this.
What would the album have become then? Jesus.
Right?
Yeah.
Imagine that. Seppo, our manager, he got in touch with them, and Prince's answer was, I don't produce no white boys. A bit of a prejudice there, huh?
Amazing.
But in any case, yeah, Prince, he declined. So, and Ian Hunter didn't do it. So we got over, and I guess through Richard Bishop, you know, the English manager who helped Zeppo, hooked up with this guy, Richard Bishop, and they started working together as a management team.
Mm.
And then the Lick Records, the label that they founded for our records to be released in Europe. And those first three or four, I mean, no, yeah, well, Self-Destruction Blues included. Bangkok Sock Saigon Shakes, Hanoi Rocks, Oriental Beat, Self-Destruction Blues, and Back to Mystery City. They were the European catalog, plus the live album that Guns N' Roses later on released in the States on their Uzi Suicide label. Which was, you know, nice. See, those bands back then, the Guns N' Roses, I thought, was great because they had their own thing. They took the right... They took the influence from Hanoi the right way.
Mm.
They got the attitude, and you know, they still had their own thing, and were kind of a bit more rough looking and heavier, kind of Aerosmith heavy sort of sound as well. So I thought that was fantastic that they had that they became the biggest band, and not these other bands that were kind of superficial, sort of phony, like Party Hardy. To me, they gave bad names, gave a bad name to rockers, you know, because it was phony. It's like this sort of pretentious chicks and booze, and you know, I can't believe how many musicians in America say, like, so why did you start playing rock and roll? For chicks, you know. <It's> like, well, lucky you could play a little on the side there, you know. So to us, it was, you know, more serious about music and all that, and and the looks, of course, was part of the thing. So
well, that record that the guys from Mata Hoople came in and produced, to me, that was like a huge evolution in the sound of the band. Like, it seemed like that was the, you know, I don't know how to put it. Like it seemed like that was where the band grew musically in a big way. That album seems very, like, I don't know, sophisticated. Maybe it's the wrong way to put it, but to my ear, that's what it does. You know, there's a lot of beautiful arrangement stuff on there, a lot of piano, a lot of instrumentation that's cool. And it's not like a bombastic, huge cannons, gun, you know, drums, kind of big giant guitars. Like, it's not that kind of record.
No.
You know what I mean? It's got a more classic feel to it. And I'm wondering how much those two guys from Mott were an influence.
Okay. Well, they probably didn't have that much to do with the sound, or apart from, yeah, I mean, you know, they produced the sound of the album, but they were nice guys. We had a good vibe with them. We had fun making their record. And they weren't too serious. And I mean, I remember Ian Hunter saying later on, when I got to know Ian, he says, well, those two couldn't get arrested as producers, mate. said, of course, the old bandmates, they're always
right. Always competitive.
Yeah. But it was a good album. Then they had Morgan Fisher, they had him later on when they were mixing. They had him do the piano stuff, like in Malibu Beach. Oh, that's interesting stuff. But at the time, I was kind of frustrated. Well, Oriental Beat had some good songs, but the producer was completely wrong. He went totally the wrong way, and that's why a lot of those songs were kind of, it's a shame because they were ruined by the sucky sound. But we were learning all the time. So Back to Mystery City, by that time, I felt like, okay, Andy didn't really want me to write that much, although I would notice once in a while, I'd notice some part of my own, some idea I'd had that ended up in his song. But if I never mentioned it, he was like, what the? I could fucking go furious over this. So I couldn't bother to fight. But in any case, at that time I decided, okay, well, I know Steve Bader's had, you know, with Steve, we had, you know, gotten to know each other, and he taught me a lot about arrangements and stuff. And, you know, like Until I Get You, he used I'm 18, Alice Cooper, as a reference point, you know, to sort of point out how the structure of the song and how it builds. And the first verse is, it takes kind of easy, and the last verse is going mental and screaming. And my eyes form, my face in my hands. And then Until I Get You also was, I'm crying at the end of the song when I'm doing the ad libs, because I was really, that was this person, this who was Steve Bader's wife, who ended up being Andy McCoy's wife, had a kid with him, whom I had a thing with a couple of years before Andy, and I could not believe Andy fell for it by that time, in 84. So, I'm in love. But
is that the woman that's all pictured on his first solo record?
Stacy, yeah, I think so, yeah, Stacy Misnev. Yeah, well, in any case, well, but I'm glad I survived, and my friendship with Steve survived. But Steve had taught me a lot about arrangements and stuff, and I could see in Andy's songs that he always tried to shove too many parts in a song, like the four or five parts, even six sometimes, and like, okay, once you, like Bob Ezrin said the same thing when he first came to see us live. He says, as soon as he starts dancing to a groove, then it changes all of a sudden. There's like too fast that you can make like, you know, two or three great songs out of one song that Andy has so many parts in, you know.
Right.
Because I like simplicity a bit more, but of course, you don't want to have everyone the same, you know, formula and basically, you know, verse, chorus, verse, you know, boring, of course. If it's it's always nice to have something different, and boy, did we have something different. It's all, so there's no head or tail. A lot of the times I could tell easily that Andy would start a song with a B verse and then do the chorus and then go like to the obvious verse. So I'd be like, okay, if you don't mind, this is, at first, when he realized I wasn't after the credit of the song, then he's like, okay, so what? I go, yeah, how about if we do it this way? And you know, so I started rearranging this stuff, because he had some great ideas and all that, but as a whole, I had more of a, you know, I had an idea and I was excited because I could contribute something.
What was going on around Two Steps from the Move? Because why did Ian Hunter come in and help complete some of the songs, like lyrically and stuff?
Well, Bob Ezrin.
Because I always wondered, because you guys, in such a brief amount of time, put out a bunch of records.
Yeah.
And then for that one, what did Andy have, writer's block or something? What was happening there? That,
well, I think it was more like a heroin block. He was, you know, it was around the time of, unfortunately, like in 83, by the time it was like 1984, I remember the first gig when the guys had done some smack, and I felt it on stage, and I didn't know what it was. I just felt like, there's something wrong here. It's like the energy is not the same. I was
right.
Like, what's the hell? Then later I realized they're all pinnied, and you know, the heroin is the killer. That's what Johnny Thunder said. Three things that kill bands: heroin, girlfriends, and managers? Death. Anyways, so I was
heroin,
like,
heroin, girlfriends, and heroin.
Yeah, exactly. So Johnny, I mean, we had a, you know, there's a single included in that Hanoi, the English version of the Hanoi book, which has a demo of I Can't Get It and Teenage Revolution, which never ended up on the Two Steps from the Move. We did it later with the new version of Hanoi. But the first line is missing from that demo. It's like, I'm coming in for the second line, because there was no first line, and Andy was staying at his house, and he says, I ain't coming to the studio. You deal with it. And okay, so what do I do? And I couldn't think of a good enough first line. So it ended up, the demo had no first line. I Can't Get It. And it always bothered me. And that's probably why it was never released until this book now.
Oh.
This is something that's never been released, a Hanoi song. So in any case, so Andy was, we went to Morocco. Zeppo, our manager's great idea, thinking like the Stones went to Marrakesh and stuff. So we went to Agadir for 2 weeks and had nothing but two acoustic guitars, no strings, one pick, broke two strings the first day, and all we came back with was the Underwater World.
Yeah, riff, yeah, sure.
The only riff. And we really were in trouble, I thought. You know, Andy wouldn't admit it, but I was like, fuck, we
didn't. It's so interesting that was going on right on the verge of you guys getting your first major label deal and worldwide record release and all that stuff.
Any moment, and something, everything could just like break, and you know, it would be all like, you know, that's what it felt like. I felt like that most of the time. Like, you know, this could all be lost and gone in a split second, and we'd be like destroyed.
Well, Sammy said something really interesting when I interviewed him, which sort of doesn't jive with the sort of the mythology around the band, which was that, because I, you know, I asked him, and it's a stupid question because there's obviously no way of really knowing what would have happened. But, you know, I think I asked him something along the lines of, like, what do you think would have happened with Hanoi had you not broken up, had Razzle not died, et cetera, et cetera. You know, like, where do you think it would have wound up? And he said that you were going out with somebody that worked at your U.S. label at that time, and that she was in a meeting with, like, the president of the label, and that he wanted to drop the band or something.
CBS?
Yeah. Is that true?
Yeah,
I mean... do you think that Hanoi, like, let's just say fantasy mode here, there was no, you know, drug addiction, there was no tragic accident with Razzle. I mean, where do you think that things would have gone musically and otherwise?
Well, musically, would have, well, CBS actually, when they signed us finally then in America, they didn't, I mean, Jude Wilder was this person that was the product manager for Hanoi Rocks.
Mm.
And she became a really good friend. She was from Baltimore and we all loved John Waters movies. It was like, it was a tradition. Every Christmas we have a John Waters marathon. And then, you know, the early ones, you know, Female Trouble, The Desperate Living and all that stuff. So Judy knew, she came to the studio and everybody loved her because she was really cool. And she would say, they asked, well, you know John Waters? And she says, yeah, she sees Edith Massey. She's got a little store. She sees her on the street every now and then. And, well, all I know about John Waters is he doesn't like sex because it smells bad. And everyone's like, ah, yeah. Judy was like, in. So she was actually the one, she always told us the truth, you know. The head of promotion said, you know, take that piece of shit off the turntable. And, you know, I don't hear a single, you know, don't you ever leave me. And
which is crazy, because my memory of it at that time was that everything was all happening. I was starting to see your videos on MTV. I was seeing your pictures in all the magazines. I mean, I became aware of you because of all that stuff. You know, I was a teenage kid in California. So it was obviously reaching, you know, way far away from where you guys had started.
Yeah, it looked like, I guess, yeah, on the outside, it can, it often looks like that too.
Right.
You never know what the real story is. But I think, yeah, we were getting there. In my mind, I thought that it was a good time to, well, but I mean, the thing was, you know, with Up Around the Bend, the song Up Around the Bend was, I mean, the Two Steps from the Move, the title track, Bob Ezrin thought it was the sickest song he ever heard. He didn't want it on the album, and we left it out.
Right, because it's not on the album, right?
It's not on the album, exactly. Which I think is pretty cool, in a way. It's kind of like Sheer Heart Attack with Queen. The album title, Sheer Heart Attack. Later on, they had that song, Sheer Heart Attack.
Right, right.
But they, so the label wanted the single, and we were on tour in Germany in a van. And the only cassette we had was Creedence Clearwater Live at Royal Albert Hall or something. And we figured we'll pick one of those songs, Hey Tonight or Bad Moon Rising or Up Around the Bend. Yeah, Up Around the Bend. Let's take that one. And we went to London. Ezrin came to London for one day, and we recorded it in, you know, one go. And the next day we mixed it, and that was the first single of the album.
Was that after you had done the whole record?
Yeah.
Was that because the label was like, we need a single?
Yeah, we had been recording. We went through the basic tracks in New York, then went to Toronto to record the rest, and then came back to New York to record more and vocals and stuff. That's when Ian Hunter came in. Bob Ezrin had, you know, I knew Ian, and he called Ian because he knew we were big fans, and, you know, so he thought it would be a thrill for us, which it was.
Mm.
And Ian came in, and he heard, we did need help, like I said, you know, Andy didn't have much. It was kind of, I mean, I remember being at his place, and he said, well, I don't have any ideas, except I got this, I don't know if this is anything, I'm probably going to throw it in the trash, but like this. I was like, yeah, that's great. Of course, because we had nothing else.
Right.
Yeah, let's go for that one. Yeah,
let's do that.
Yeah, yeah. So that's how, but we, some lyrics were missing, and Ian was really interested. He was interested because Andy had, you know, we all were in New York for the first time. He had a little bottle of, you know, little nose candy, you know. I remember when he offered to Ian, he says, oh, you want a hit? I said, oh, no, thanks, mate. No, thanks, mate. You go ahead. You knock yourself out. I was like, just, ha, ha, ha. So then, it's funny, because I don't know if that was the reason, but his idea, the lyrics for Boulevard of Broken Dreams, it's a double meaning. It's about cocaine, but for a teeny bopper, it would be about, you know, relationship, you know.
Sure.
You're having an affair with the Snow Queen, whatever. You know, all these broken dreams have made me see that I'm strung out. Somebody rescue me. Do I have to tell you that I love you? Do I have to tell you, show you that I care? Do I have to tell you that I need you to be there in the middle of the night when I'm much too weak to fight? You know, you're such a welcome sight. In the middle of the night, yeah. Boulevard of Broken Dreams. I talk so bad and I act so mean and I got to get back on my feet. You know, the lyrics are about, you know, it can be depending on how you look at it, so it's a double meaning.
Right, sure.
So it's very smart. From I love stuff like that. With so Ian said he took those three songs, right?
Mm-hmm.
I Can't Get It, Boulevard of Broken Dreams, and Underwater World. He took the rough mixes, you know, instrumental versions home with him, and he was going to work. He said he'll get back to us in about a week or so. He came back the same night he had written all those lyrics.
Mm.
He had them all ready the next day.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
He was so he was so excited. He got inspired. So he wrote them all in one go the same night. There you go, mate. Cheers. Thanks. And there were some of the coolest lyrics.
Was he involved in creating like the vocal melodies and everything too for it?
No, it's just lyrics. Just lyrics, I think.
How cool.
Yeah. And we had this guy, Pete Burns, who used to write for Cream. I think Pete Burns, his name was. He was in England. And he there's two lines from his lyrics that we used. He had a bunch of stuff. And I smoked a lot of sky, drank a lot of rain. In some of his poetry, but it was kind of hippy-dippy kind of stuff, and it was, that hippie. Jack Bruce came to the studio, of course, perfect timing. Bob was a friend, friends with Jack Bruce, so Sammy happened to be just doing his bass part. It was like, oh, shit, great, okay, Jack Bruce is there, feeling intimidated. But then Andy, of course, his timing, he says, like, who the fuck was that guy, Pete Burns, whatever, he was a hippie, horrible lyrics, he didn't do nothing, man, just useless. So Jack Bruce says, well, he only wrote hits like Sunshine of Our Love and In the White Room or something, and Stormed Out of the Room. Nice one, Andy. Great. Yeah, that made a great impression. But later on, me and Sammy were talking. He was in the lobby. We hung out with Jack Bruce later in the lounge, and it was cool. But it was so funny. He always, I mean, we would have gotten signed to Chrysalis Records already in like 82, 83, but Andy went with Richard Bishop, went to meet the head of the label, and before they could do it, before anything happened, Andy said, what, Jethro Tull, that horrible, but it was like slagging Jethro Tull, who were the foundation of the whole company. They, you know, got him all their money, you know, that was the biggest selling artist in that company. Whoops. So it's like, okay, that was it, but that was for the, so much for that deal, you know. But in Ezrin, first of all, he whipped us into shape, and he didn't tolerate any slacking off. And you know, we've been like, I mean, Back to Mystery City was a lot of fun, and it was creative, and I was really, Steve had taught me how to think of the vocal that I was going to do, like in Until I Get You. Mm. Think about it until you're in tears, and you're really like in that head, and then sing it.
Right.
And really, it was exciting to me, so because I figured, oh, yeah, I'm evolving my learning. And I can utilize all this knowledge that I now know and see how it works out. And it was cool. It was a nice, fun thing. But Bob Ezrin turned us into pros.
Right.
That was like the big difference. That he wanted to meet. He saw our show, and then he wanted to meet me first, which made Andy crazy. He was like, "Why does he want to meet you, man? I write most of the songs." And I don't know. Maybe he wants to talk about my performance, which it was. I went to meet him at one of Dave Gilmour's houses. He was staying at the David Gilmour's house in. They were making that record About Face, his second solo album at the time too. So Ezrin, he just said that, you know, so I liked, that's when he told me he likes the groove, and as soon as he starts dancing, then it changes, you know, that's right. One thing, he thinks too many parts in songs maybe, and then he said, how many times did you go up in the PA? I don't know, maybe two, three or something. I counted 7. Okay, so, well, you know, after you do it so many times, you lose the effect. You know, if you're up there once, you'll go, wow, he's up there. Maybe a second time, okay. But then if you do it more, and it's like, okay, ho-hum, same old, you know, it's not even.
So he was weighing in not just on the making of the record, but it, like on just
performance,
the presentation of your band.
Yes, everything, the whole package. And he really felt like the same spirit like with the Alice Cooper band.
Right.
And it was going to be a longer relationship with him, with us. Right.
You think he would have done the next record?
Yes.
Had there been another?
Yes. Right. It would have been a fruitful relationship from then on. We became, it really was a special vibe. He loved Razzle. He loved the band.
Hmm.
And he felt like he was back in the game with, you know, like the Alice Cooper band early days. But he said, there's one problem, when I was just me and him at the first meeting, he says, there's one problem, but I know I can deal with it, though. It kind of, what, you mean Andy? Yeah, he kind of reminds me of Glenn Buxton in the Alice Cooper band. Well, this is a love-hate kind of thing, but I can deal with him. And so which he did.
He had like, when did it become, when did, like, everybody's drug use become, you know, an unworkable problem?
Well, it always was. It was, I think it was just the heroin. That was it.
Sure.
I mean, the heroin is the killer. That just, like, turns people into assholes, like selfish scumbags, and really, like, just changes you so much that that was, I think, the worst thing that happened, you know. But we're still going to be fine as long as we were, you know, stayed out of trouble. Yeah, because I stopped everything when, you know, I've been doing speed and all that. And then I figured, oh, I'm going to move into the heroin and stop speed. Oh, great. Great idea. I'm going to be better off. And I realized, and then I ended up doing both. And, you know, I just was going crazy. And at the end of 83, I remember seeing the video, some first roughs of the All Those Wasted Years live.
Yeah.
And I flipped out. It's the first time I saw myself live. I was like, God, am I like that, man? I was like, phew. I was getting dizzy. Like, oh God, is this, that's me? And really, like, really, I'm gonna go crazy. And some reason, I just.
What, you didn't like it? You didn't?
No.
Did you not like what you saw?
No.
Really?
Yeah. I thought I was like, I don't know what it was. I was just like, I didn't like myself at all. I was like, God, am I like that? And I'm too wired, and you know, I just hated myself there. And I decided, this is it. I'm gonna stop everything. I'm not gonna even smoke a joint anymore. I'm just stop all the drugs and all that stuff. And I mean, I went through the heroin period. It wasn't that long, and I hated that. I really didn't enjoy it that much. It was more an association with that girlfriend. But however, to me, once you stop something, you decide to stop it. You gotta have the will to stop it. You know, rehab, to me, if someone else does it for you, I don't think it sticks.
You have to actually want it.
Yes. So then I stopped everything. I started exercising and swimming, and I lost all my weight. I guess I was like anorexic, you know, to a certain extent, because I was what was like 40 under 50 kilos, and I'm like 183 centimeters, 6'2" or something, 183 centimeters tall, and under 50 kilos. I could touch my finger around my waist, like my fingers, my thumb, I could touch.
Jesus.
Yeah. So I was just, you know, I woke up in the morning, I ran to the swimming hall, as I swam for an hour or two without stopping, and then came back home, had a little muesli or something, and then later in the evening, a little salad, and not too much fat, and, you know, then I got real skinny. I was skinnier than Andy. That's not even funny anymore. Yeah. Even though he had no muscle tone, because he never exercised, but except for this. I get enough exercise, push it by luck. So the management was saying, like, Jesus, we can't go on tour. You're looking like that. It was before HIV and the AIDS and all that. So, I mean, if that would have been around, then people would have been, for sure, they thought I was sick or something, you know.
Right.
So I kind of see it, but in a way, I took pleasure in knowing that everyone was like, oh, God, look at Michael. God, it's just skin and bone. And I was like, oh, well, yeah, does it bother you? And, you know, in a way, it was my way of saying screw you to everyone, because I felt kind of.
So you got healthy even back then?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I started exercising. We had a black belt karate guy who was our tour manager, and he showed me this routine of an exercise, a series of like straight leg kicks, first stretches, and then kicks, and then this five things you do like 20 times each, like real fast, like 20 push-ups, like stomach, what do you call this?
Crunches,
and then you know, the squats, throw your feet in the back, and then jump in the air, those jumps. And then squats and kicks.
This can be part of your documentary, the Michael Monroe workout plan.
Yeah, it's been done.
Bonus feature.
Didn't the Kiss guy do it already? None of it, yeah. Yeah, and then in the end, you go like, you know, from one side to another. It's kind of like you do this, I end up doing like under almost, you know, 2.5 minutes or whatever my record was. But it's kind of like running around the block. You could do it in your hotel room in a small space. So I did that in the morning. If there was a pool in the hotel, I would go swim. Then we had a gig at night. So I was getting in great shape. You know, a couple of weeks into the tour, I was like walking through brick walls. And the guys had resented me for not drinking 24 hours and smiling in the morning. It's like, what are you so happy about?
Yeah. I always say quitting drinking in a rock and roll band is bad for your career.
Yeah, it's true, because the other guy doesn't stop, and then it becomes a conflict.
Yes.
You know, yeah, it's usually it's quitting the drugs becomes the problem as opposed to doing it.
Right, exactly.
Right?
Well, with all this, you know, all the books and the box set and everything, usually that leads into a reunion tour of some sort. And obviously, you know, Hanoi did reform at one point a few years ago.
We were reborn,
but without
yeah.
Sammy and Nasty.
Yeah.
And I know Nasty's like a pharmacist or something.
Yes,
now,
a pharmacist.
Right?
Yes. Yeah.
But at that time, you weren't playing with Sammy, and I was just wondering if there's any, you know, was there any talk around these book releases or anything of you guys getting together with the original crew? Because I know Gyp Casino's still around, right?
Yeah. Well, no. It was me who always said no, I guess, because to me, Hanoi was. Had to be one band that wouldn't do a reunion just for the money, or, you know,
right.
to have, if it was a new thing, which when the reunion, well, I'll call it the rebirth, when me and Andy got acquainted in Finland years later in 2002, when we ran into each other and I saw he wasn't on Smack anymore and whatever, seemed like, wow, hey, this could be interesting to get to know him. And him, by that time, he had, after the Not Faking It album, he learned to respect my songwriting and you know, he had a new, you know, it was mutual respect, and we actually started working like 50-50. So it was exciting to me to see what we could accomplish after all these years at that point, as we were more like, he was recovering from falling down with the third story balcony.
Oh, right, right.
Yeah, I mean, it's a miracle he's alive, let alone that he can walk.
Yeah.
And my wife, Jude Wilder, who was the product manager at CBS, she was at first my friend, but then when I moved to New York, we became like, you know, we got married, you know, later, and she was my wife for 15 years. And she passed away when we had moved to Finland in 2001 in the summer, and I was recovering from that, and, you know, based on tragedy, actually, the whole thing was Andy was recovering, learning to walk again with his legs were like in, you know, hundreds of pieces, you know, really. So that's when we started kind of we had, you know, old ideas that we've worked on, reworked, and started creating something new. That's the only reason I would do, and it was a big question, was whether to call it Hanoi Rocks or Monroe McCoy or whatever.
Right, right.
And then we just figured, well, it was our name. We started together, two of us, and, you know, why not? Because of this accident and everything was taken away from us, it's okay to use the name, I thought. And that was the three albums we made. It was necessary. I was actually willing to do that the rest of my life. It would have continued to be fun, but it started slipping back into the old, hey, you're nothing without me and all that. You know, okay, you don't want to do this anymore? Fine. There's no more fun, then let's put it to bed and bury Hanoi Rocks for good.
Right.
It's really not going to ever happen, because I would never do a reunion for just a reunion.
Right, right, you know, right.
Because it's for the wrong reasons to me.
Sure.
So therefore, there was never any talk like that.
Well, so what's going on now for you? What are you up to?
Well, it's funny because the new reborn Hanoi was actually the band was me and Andy and the rest of the guys pretty much. And the new in 2009, after we had put that to bed, finally, Sammy came to New York with the New York Dolls, came to Finland to play. And we met, we hadn't seen each other for a long time, and they invited me up to play some sax and harp and, you know, personality crisis or something. And Sammy and me hung out the rest of the night till like 4 a.m. in Turku, where I live. And he said he wants to work with me again. I said, wow, well, there's half the band there.
Right.
So we started working the band, putting the band together, and by the January 2010, we were in LA with Ginger and Sammy and me and Carl Rockfist ended up, Jimmy Clark was the original drummer, but then he couldn't commit to it full time. So then we got, at the last minute, after 3 weeks of rehearsal, we got Carl in very quickly and checked him out. Worked out better with him. It was the right, you know, and he's still in the same band except for the other guitar player. Ginger changed to Dragon and Dragon to Rich Jones.
Right.
Other than that, it's the same band. So this is more of a band that, even though it's called Michael Monroe, it's more of a band than the reborn Hanoi Rocks was.
Right.
As a chemistry, because I'm a band-oriented kind of guy, and I always like, you know, the chemistry, especially with Sammy being my blood brother. We were always very close and always had, when he moved to New York. By the way, I never lived in L.A.
You never did? I thought you were based out of L.A. like maybe around the time of the Nights Are So Long.
It was New York. Okay. I always lived in New York. L.A. was really not. First time I saw the Hollywood sign was on my way to see Razzle's dead body when I wanted to see it. I didn't believe it and wanted to see it. And on the way there, I saw the Hollywood sign for the first time. And every time I see the sign, I get like kind of
gives
cold
you a shudder.
Yeah, a little bit, you know. I mean, I don't blame L.A. for it, but it's just the vibe is not my thing, you know. Right. I like New York. I like the city and, you know, the streets and reality in your face and no phony kind of, you know, like, hey, dude, how you doing? Hey, I couldn't believe it. What's going on? Michael Monroe. And I resented the fact that these bands were like sort of being influenced by Hanoi. Everyone's telling me, I said, okay, great, but that's it? That's what they thought that we were. I mean, the guy from who produced Rick Browdy, who produced the first Poison album. This guy, He's actually a nice guy. I never knew him. I didn't know who he was. He came up to me at the Ritz. I just moved to New York like in 85, end of 85. So just like a beginning of 86 or something. I went to see Mason Ruffner, this guitar player, R&B kind of from New Orleans at the Ritz. And this guy comes up to me and says, "Hey, Michael Monroe, right?" "Yes." "I wanted to apologize to you about Poison." I says, "What? Did you put something in my drink or what?" He says, "No, the band, Poison, man. Because after you, when you guys, Hanoi Rocks, when your drummer died and you broke up, we took your thing and made millions." I says, "What? Is that what you were trying to do? Hey, man, don't worry about it. You didn't even come close. You know, you missed the whole point, man. Don't worry about it. My sleep is untroubled. I wish you the same." So he we played in L.A. a few years ago. Somebody told me that I had run into Rick Browdy, and he had told the same story to someone.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he's a cool guy, apparently, as much from what I've heard.
Yeah, it's funny how much that
guilt.
Your guys' influence, well, there's, yeah.
But they missed the point.
I never heard it musically. I just heard it, like, it's almost like nobody...
Exactly.
Nobody heard those records the same way I
did. Didn't get that.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
Yeah.
You got the right idea. Just like the Mötley Hoople and the Damned, and you know, and that's why that was the coolest thing about the band.
Right.
So most of these, of course, these guys went out and sell millions of records, and people think, oh, that's rock and roll, yeah. So then the next generation looking up to them, I mean, these guys are already thinking that probably the guitar players think that Ace Frehley is he's the god, you know, and then the next generation, well, I call it rock and roll degeneration in a way, but I mean, yeah. I don't want to, I'm trying not to say anything negative, but no, the truth is, you know, it was phony rock and roll. It's a crime.
Right, right.
Really, you know, yeah. I've always embarrassed to say, I mean, people say, are you guys in a band or something? Are you a rock and roll singer or something? No.
Well, it's funny.
Aspiring plumber.
There's so much good rock and roll, and then just that little brief period in the late 80s, like, it's still... like a, you know, people can't get over the sort of shittiness of it, you know what I mean? It's just, yeah. Like, it was just this little period in the late 80s where things got really janky,
right?
You know what I mean?
But the bands who last, the strong, if you're strong enough, you last for any genre or fad or fashion, you know, the ones that are left standing and the test of time on the songs when you listen to those records.
Sure, sure.
Ain't much today's records, there isn't much that sounds better than what we already had in the 60s and 70s.
Right.
Most of the stuff, the way things are going, and it doesn't look like it's getting much better. But thank God for guys like you and us. We're trying to keep rock and roll alive. And with this band I have now, I feel it's the best, my solo career, best band I ever had in my solo career. And this 30-year celebration, I mean, it's two CDs here, man. We got the old stuff, the first CD, and the duet with Steve Bader's, It's a Lie.
Mm.
That's an important one, because that version is magical and much better than the one that ended up on the Nights Are So Long album.
Right.
And because me and Steve lived together and stuff at the time. And then Slash even allowed me to use that one Magic Carpet Ride Steppenwolf cover that we did for the Coneheads movie soundtrack.
Oh, right.
We had a different version, arrangement idea to do it in a different way from the original. So Slash said, okay, let's do both versions and see which one the label picks. So the record company, the movie company, they picked the new arrangement version. So the other version that was like the original was never used anywhere, but I had audio cassette of it for all these years since 1993. Kenny Aronoff on drums, Dizzy Reed on keyboard, Sanyaf on bass, and Izzy Stradlin actually sings backing vocals on that version too.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so I had it. I emailed Slash. I said, wow, man, this is such a cool version. It's a shame it never came out, and no one's ever going to hear it. I guess it would be too much of a hassle to try and negotiate it for me to have the right to use it on this compilation. Slash says, oh, all you have to worry about is paying the songwriters for the publishing. Sure, go ahead, you can use it.
Oh, nice.
I love you. he's the biggest heart, man. He's such a sweetheart. So me, who doesn't have much you know, funds, or, you know, not too much money to throw around, with respect and integrity, you get that kind of favors back. See,
that's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, when I think of it now, so I know we got to wind down. Ain't It Fun, when I did that duet first in memory of Steve Bader's.
Yeah.
That was like, I went there to LA to play some sax and harmonica on that User Illusion album, on that song, Bad Obsession.
Mm.
And Axel had not heard the Dead Boys, so I made him a tape of the Dead Boys, and we were driving around in Hollywood in his car, and then he heard Ain't It Fun, and said, wow, this song's got to be on the, we're making a cover album with cover songs. And he called Slashers, put the band together. We're doing this song and we're doing it as a duet. I said, wow. So could it be possible that Steve Bader's name could be mentioned in memory of Steve Bader? He said, yeah, yeah, sure. So I said, oh, great. So now Steve can get, you know, my dear friend and my, you know, one of my all-time, you know, idols, and he would get, his name would be seen by millions of people on the album cover in memory of Steve Bader's.
Yeah, sure.
So all I asked for is just, put in memory of Steve Bader's and spell my name right. I don't want any money, nothing like that. I just want the song on the album.
Yeah,
you know. Cause, and there was, it ended up being the first single, I think, too.
Yeah,
so, it was so cool, and it was magical. And we sang it together. Even Axel sounds like Steve in places. It sounds like
what, channeling his spirit.
Yeah, it was a trio. Yeah. Actually, when you think of it, I feel like he's got to get a gun. And some words, he comes out just like Steve. Like, whoa. It was a really a cool thing to do. I was so happy for that. But I didn't ask for any money for that. My manager at the time says, okay, I'm going to negotiate. You stay the hell out of this. You stay as far as you can, okay? You don't touch it. You're not touching this, because I wanted to make sure they didn't think I was greedy or anything like that.
Yeah,
you know, I
just
wanted
sure.
to make sure that song is on the album, which it was. And but I never asked for anything for that. And now karma's coming back. I get to use this song with Slash, which was actually originally was Slash's project. So I was really,
that's so cool, man.
Yeah, and we got a new single, One Foot Out of the Grave, and a couple of outtakes from the Blackout States album, A Fistful of Dynamite and Simple Town, and the song called Get On. I was on Horns and Halos bonus track in Japan, previously unreleased stuff, and good compilation. The second CD is from the last three albums, plus the bonus track.
Right.
Three songs of each album, because I think the last three albums are some of the best, the strongest material I've done. The first CD has the old albums. Usually, normally it's two songs per album, except Demolition 23 has this four songs of that one, because that's been out of print for so long.
And right.
It hasn't been available. And the Dead Time Stories I've dedicated to Steve Bader's. It's actually, that's another Steve related song where I'm within the lyrics, there's about 15 titles, Steve Bader's titles from the Dead Boys or solo stuff, and you know, within the lyrics. That's my tribute to him when after he passed away, I wrote that. And
cool, man.
Yeah, so this is out, and we're making a movie, and we keep on rocking with this band, and before too long, we make the next studio album. And one of these days, I hope that I get into a position where I can say, okay, here's the money. Take us on the road with you for a year or two, please. Thank you. I get someone else. Get Alice Cooper, and yeah.
yeah.
But yeah.
Cool, man. Well, it's exciting, man. I can't wait to see how the documentary comes out, and I can't wait to see what you do next, man. Thank you for taking the time to do this today.
Thank you for having me.
I've been wanting to interview you for so fucking long.
Really?
Yeah.
So it's been a couple of years now.
Yeah. So I'm so excited that we finally sat down and did it. Great.
I gotta do the harp then. Now it's done. Thank you.
Nice.
I'll tell you, everywhere else is just nowhere.
All right, that was Michael Monroe, rock and roll legend on Walking the Floor. Make sure you get on over to walkingthefloor.com. And I'm going to throw some killer links up there, links to his website so you can check him out, check out his music, buy his tickets and t-shirts, etc., etc. But I'm also going to throw together a little glam rock starter course for you. I'm going to put together some videos of Hanoi Rocks in their heyday. I'm going to throw maybe like some Mata Hoople, little Alice Cooper, little New York Dolls. Get you kids out there on the right rock and roll track. Okay, that's it for this week. I'll be back in a couple of weeks, and I don't know who the hell it's going to be with. So tune in then and check it out. Adios, amigos!